Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. Francine Lacroix and Tom Keene, and we are reporting on this economics, this politics from these meetings on the shores of Lake Como, and we welcome all of you worldwide today. What we know is there is a pin drop when Mohamed El-Erian speaks of game theory. The game theory right now has never been more complex between politics, economics, and indeed finance as well. Francine and I were up at 5 a.m. having four-pull espressos over the eight themes we would talk to Dr. El-Erian today. I want to go to Davos. Why do you never go to Davos? Why do we never see you there?
Because I prefer the small gathering, honestly.
Okay, fine. The theme at Davos was the European banking system has to clear themselves, and they can't clear themselves because of negative interest rates. Was Ken Rogoff right? There'd be a point where negative interest rates would not be efficacious.
Not just Ken Rogoff. I think Ben Bernanke, as far back as 2010, warned us that when it comes to using unconventional policies for macroeconomic objectives, it's about benefits, costs, and risks.
Right.
And the longer you persist, the lower the benefits, the higher the cost and the risk. And that's where we are today.
I want to go to your wheelhouse, which is a binomial distribution of game theory and all that. The fact is negative interest rates, you've got clear outcomes early on, and then they become diffuse. Is the value of negative interest rates now far more diffuse than it was X number of years ago?
In my opinion, yes, for two reasons. One is that the transmission mechanism is stretched, if not exhausted. And the second reason is that we now realize that when you run at negative interest rates for a long time, you undercut the ability of the financial sector to provide credit and the financial sector to provide long-term financial protection, which means risk aversion among households goes up. And that's what we're experiencing now.
But who's realizing? Are central banks realizing?
Yes. I mean, Mario Draghi at his last press conference actually mentioned it. And for this to come from the ECB is quite a change in terms of recognizing it's also about costs and benefits, not just the costs and risks, not just benefits.
Given where we are, has the ECB actually lost the window to hike or normalize? And is this a policy mistake?
So I think that window has closed tremendously. But I think what's key, and the ECB and Mario Draghi has been very good, is to stress it's not about central banks. It's about the response of other policymakers with better tools. And he said, you know, you look at his press conference, a quarter of it is spent saying it's not about us.
But he said it for 5 years and no one was listening.
Correct. And now it's become even more urgent. And if it doesn't, you're starting to see it around the world, is that central banks get pushed too hard and starts risking their political independence. And that's a big issue.
There's a growth problem in Germany. There's a growth problem in Italy. Does the ECB have the tools, if it were to turn ugly, to deal with it?
No. I mean, that's the most that the ECB can do is buy some time. But I want you to keep the image of a patient that is hooked on painkillers and not dealing with their structural impediments. The more you get hooked, two things happen. You become addicted, and the side effects become worse and worse. So can that medication buy you some more relief? Yes, but it comes at quite a cost.
What should be the approach of economics, the theorists like you, to defend Chairman Powell? We had LBJ going after McChesney Martin over the need for inflation after the assassination of JFK. Now we've got a new bout of this. Kevin Warsh happens to be in the radar this week. How did the guys like you protect the banker, Jerome Powell?
We explained over and over again that central banks have gone out of their way to carry a policy burden that's way beyond their tools, and that this is not about central banks. I think that message has to be stressed over and over again.
How do you respond to the fact Marvin Goodfriend got buried within the process, and now we will have Mr. Kane, a businessman, as a Fed officer? How do we explain that to the American public and to the financial elite?
It's part of a bigger phenomenon where people have lost trust with expert opinion. People have lost trust with the profession of economics, and therefore it is okay in the view of these people to appoint non-economists to economic position. it is a much broader reflection. There is a significant trust deficit that has developed, particularly with respect to economics. Now, economics is partly responsible for this.
There's a biplane coming in here. It looks like out of the 1930s. I think that's Noriel.
Noriel is coming up next. In the meantime, that's an important point, Mohammed, which will, of course, continue on. Mohammed El-Erian, the lack of trust. He is from Allianz and Bloomberg Opinion.
It is Fredo, and in French,
Fredo.
That's where we are. And where we are is with the strength of the OECD. Catherine Mann is our chief economist, and now Laurence Boone taking over for Dr. Mann. How have the first weeks been, the first quarters been at OECD? It's a big change to go to an institution that large.
And the first month change, it's been a big change, both for me and for the global economic outlook. I hope it's not correlated, but it hasn't ceased deteriorating.
We had a wonderful conversation a number of days ago with a leading economist about the inability of the IMF to get out front and gain the economy, that everything was a look back. The OECD, to me, really tries to look forward to what's going to happen. As you look forward into 2019, and within your perspective, 2022, what do you see for global economic growth?
So I think a big change in the major driver of global economic growth, which is that the trade openness that we have lived through and which has really lifted not only all economies, but a third of the planet out of poverty, that's going to change drastically because of all the challenges to openness from politics and from the rising inequality which has taken place over the past two decades. And looking forward, there's another element, which is digitalization, which combined with open economy is actually revolutionizing the labor market. Let me just give you one number.
Please.
If we look at the next 10 years, 14% of the jobs will disappear, 30% will change significantly. That's a revolution for everybody who's working today.
Laurence, it seems that there was a lot of pessimism, right, on the world economy. Now the markets are a little bit optimistic. Then next week they may change. Does it all have to do with that consumption number in China? Is that the kind of end-all be-all?
I think it's China has been contributed to a third of economic growth over the past decade, so global growth. So yes, that's a massive number. But when we look at the short term, like what you're leading to, the major swings coming from other emerging markets. Like, look at Turkey. It's been driving the change and the decline in European growth to a very significant extent, much more than China, actually.
What would be your prescription to fix European growth? Germany is in a struggle. Italy is probably much worse.
So, yes, Italy is in recession at the moment. And Germany is, we project Germany to rise 0.8%, which is weak by the standards. Leverage on Europe. We have a single market and we have a common currency that's protecting Europe from all the fluctuation that that may happen. So first, coordinate fiscal policy. Half of Europe can actually do and should support their economic activity with public investment. If we want to be able to compete in tomorrow's digital world, we need digital infrastructure. There are many regions in Europe, especially in the north, where your mobile phone will just stop working. So that's the first thing. The second is reform. Let business grow and flourish. Cut red tape administration. That's super important.
Where are we in this gilded age? The OECD has been out front on inequality, Gini coefficient, that kind of analysis. Yeah. How gilded is the gilded age right now?
Well, the true issue, and that relates to the first question you asked me, which shows how prescient you are, is this hollowing out of the middle-skilled workers. That's, to a large extent, what the reason of the resentment from the Yellow Jacket to Brexit to the populist vote everywhere on the planet you can think about. And this is going to worsen if we don't address it now through redistribution. And to be able to redistribute, we need this common tax that the OECD is working, the global common tax. And looking forward, we need to give access to more people to education, to healthcare, everywhere. And the G20 is looking at this. Mm-hmm. So I've got hope.
Let's talk Brexit with Nouriel Roubini from Roubini Macro Associates. Of course, he's their founder and chief executive. Nouriel, when you look at Brexit, the longer you delay it, does it mean that actually Brexit could also not happen? Or you'll get such a soft Brexit, which is kind of what the markets have been pricing in, that it won't really have much of an impact?
Well, one thing I know for sure, we're not going to have a hard Brexit because it's going to be not just a disaster for the UK, but also for Europe. Europe is on the verge of a recession. The last thing they need is a market and a confidence shock coming from hard Brexit. So whether they like it or not, the Europeans will have to delay also the Brexit decision, whether it's to June or later, we don't know. Of course, the longer you delay it, if it's beyond June 30, the UK will have to participate in new election. That means MPs, it means commissioner, and therefore the chance that then eventually there is a change in government and there's going to be a second referendum and you don't get Brexit at all becomes more likely. I still have of the belief that probably we're going to get Brexit, some variant of the current withdrawal agreement, might happen by June rather than a reversal of Brexit. But we're not going to get hard Brexit, and that's actually positive for the markets.
But your scenario is what? A general election that could actually you could see a scenario where Boris Johnson becomes, you know, the leader of the Conservatives and wins the election, right?
Yeah.
So what does that mean for Brexit? And what if the referendum is, again, 54, 46 the other way? Do we have a third referendum?
Well, as I said, I don't know whether we're going to get a soft Brexit rather than a reversal of Brexit. All those options are on the table. I think from an economic and market point of view, avoiding a hard Brexit is the most important thing. That's the first observation. Secondly, you know, once, if and when Boris Johnson becomes prime minister, I think he's a bit of a political opportunist. At that point, he's going to want to do a deal with Europe rather than wanting a hard Brexit. He pretend to be a hard Brexiter. He's not, and so on. And the question is, of course, whether you're going to go to European election with the UK or not. If it's with the UK, then the chances are that eventually you have either general election or a referendum, and then you can reverse that decision.
Is it constructive to have the debate we're having between Governor Carney and former Governor Mervyn King? They seem to be going back and forth on what no deal means as well. Is that a constructive debate right now?
Well, I don't think it's a constructive debate in the sense that of course, there is an ongoing debate about what's going to be the consequences of different types of Brexit. Most people believe that hard Brexit is going to be terrible for the United Kingdom. We are having a political noise, having also noise among former and current policymakers is not very constructive right now.
It is Jacob Frankel of J.P. Morgan Chase International, their chairman, but that barely describes his accomplishments in economics. Lars Hansen is Chicago now. The laureate is the David Rockefeller Professor. And long ago, a few years ago, the first David Rockefeller Professor at Chicago was one Jacob Frankel. And he joins us today, not on foreign exchange dynamics and the rest of it, but the grace of how central banks should act. As we speak to you as a former governor of the Bank of Israel, did any political leadership in Israel ever want a can, Jacob Frankel?
I'm sure that every day, everywhere, political leaderships want to.
But it's gotten messy, hasn't it?
Well, right, the important point is that the central bank's credibility is so high today and has been the best protection of central bank policies. And that's why when everyone is still engaged with the extinguishing the fires of the crisis of today, central banks are enshrined in not only dealing with the fires of yesterday, but also securing the stability that is so important for growth and development.
The common theme here of Lyndon Baines Johnson and McChesney Martin in the 60s as well, I need growth, I need inflation, I need the economy to pop. That's exactly the language we would hear from President Trump. Why do politicians want that when there's so many smart guys like you around saying, no, you can't have the punch bowl 24/7, 10 years in a row?
And indeed, the test of a good central banker is that he can take the punch bowl away before the party gets going. It is indeed the inclination of politicians to have a short-run benefit. But occasionally, those short-run benefits are coming at very high cost in the long run. And the best way that central banks can contribute to growth is by lengthening the horizon, by securing stability in the financial system and in the price area.
But when can they take the punch bowl away? It seems like this is, you know, the carrot, but actually it's never coming because the economy's ups and downs. Have we actually missed a window? And I'm especially thinking of the European Central Bank.
Well, one of the key points that we have learned is that being the only game in town is a mixed blessing. In fact, it has become a curse. And since the crisis, the only game in town have been the central banks. They have been overburdened. And before long, they looked around and said, hey, where are my troops? They are gone. Governments need to wake up. It is time for not only fiscal policy, but also what we call in the jargon structural policies, which in short mean making the economy more flexible and contributing to productivity and growth. So, yes, it's not an issue of lowering interest rates. Right. Interest rates are as low as they could ever be.
But this is not going to get easier because actually politicians who have always wanted to be reelected also now realize that they have the populace to contend with. So the more they're tough on reforms, the more they lose their job quickly.
This may be the case, but if I look, for example, two examples. Look at the head of Germany, Schröder, who did very, very tough measures. He paid political price, and Germany was booming thereafter. Even in Israel, when Prime Minister Netanyahu was, at the time, Minister of Finance, he did the tough policies, was very unpopular, paid political price, and the economy was booming. So I really think that at the end of the day, you need to be a statesman, and a statesman needs to ask not how am I reelected, but how can I improve the state of the economy if it is in the economic sphere.
So the Israeli elections are a couple of days away. We cannot mention polls. We were discussing it last night. What are the nuances of this elections that markets don't understand?
Well, the short answer is very technical one. There are many, many small parties that may not cross the threshold that is needed in order to enter. If they don't cross the threshold, the votes that went to them are gone. And therefore, when you do public opinion polls, which you are not allowed now anymore, you have to take into account that many of the votes may be gone. So paradoxically, those parties that will not be elected into parliament, into our Knesset, may be those that will decide on the balance between the center-right and the center-left government.
We're going to be going to the IMF meetings in Washington. They put out those fancy books, and one is the Green Book, which is on financial stability as well. What's the tail risk right now? As Jacob Frenkel synthesizes all of the economics into that risk that's out on the left tail, how malleable is that right now? How flexible is it right now?
Well, financial stability is key, and that's the main lesson from the crisis which we now commemorate, I will not say celebrate, the 10th anniversary or so. Traditionally, it was said that central banks need to focus on price stability. We have learned that financial stability is as important, and it is relevant today. And the reason is that the more you push interest rates down, you have the illusion that you stimulate the economy, but you also make the financial system more vulnerable. People ask, where is the inflation? You have printed and printed and printed. We don't see it in the CPI, in the Consumer Price Index, but you do see it in the financial markets. And if your financial markets are growing on soft land, they will be more fragile. That's why it is so important to strengthen the financial system. You know, the most important key test for a strong economy is the strength of its financial system, because that's the element that can derail prosperity.
Welcome all of you across America, SiriusXM Channel 119 and worldwide to this important discussion. And you just can't have a workshop or a 200, 300 person elite seminar in Italy without Luigi Zingales. He is without question the definitive link between Europe and America on the study of capitalism, of course, at the Booth School, Chicago. And as a child, had a un banco de limonada. I think as a kid, Cameron Chrysler going after the academics who don't understand the incentives of capitalism. You're the global expert. How are we doing in capitalism right now in America?
Actually, I was not running a lemonade stand, but I was a bike mechanic as a small kid. So okay. I do understand some of these things. I think that the system in the United States is doing in this moment better than Europe. Europe is very soft from an economic point of view. I think particularly Germany. And the thing that remains to be understood is whether this is just a technical factor or is just the China demand that is soft, and as a result, the entire chain from Germany and then expanded to Italy and the rest of Europe is softer.
One of the great things about these international conferences is nobody talks about healthcare, because everybody's sort of got a healthcare system they're happy with, is a general statement. Except the United States. Right now in the United States is an ever-growing piece of the pie going to healthcare. Are we struggling with our wage growth because so much of it's going to healthcare instead of going to our pockets?
Absolutely. I remember that in my 2012 book, I have a picture showing what people bring home and what they are paid, and there is a big difference. And this big difference is mostly due to healthcare costs. And so workers in the United States don't see the benefits of growth, because mm-hmm. this growth goes into the pockets of the healthcare industry as a whole. So I think that we need a serious reform in healthcare to reduce the cost and actually make it more efficient. People in Italy live much longer than the United States. And part of it, of course, is a good wine and good olive oil. But part of it is that there is more generalized health care than in the United States.
Well, let's go to Gary Becker, then, the giant, the late Gary Becker, the laureate, the giant of Chicago, what I'll call social economics. Steve Levitt doing Freakonomics as well. We're all looking for a solution to this, instead of the painful water torture quarter after quarter, year after year as well. Do you see a solution out there, or do we just stagger on into this new decade?
You mean a solution to the healthcare? Or
to the healthcare and to our happiness with our jobs. We're a fully employed America, but essentially everybody's miserable.
I don't think everybody's miserable, but the vast majority is miserable, and the reason is very simple. If you look at the median wage in the United States, especially for male workers, has not gone up in 40 years. So they are miserable because they're not making a higher wage, and one of the reasons is, as we're discussing, part of it is mm-hmm. eaten by healthcare, and part of it is that I think competition has pushed wages less up than in the past, and so maybe we should promote this. We are discussing earlier about the employment report, but part of the issue is why wages are so soft in a moment that employment is so full. I think mm-hmm. that it's a puzzle, and we should try to fix that.
Well, this has been wonderful. Luigi Zagalos, love to see you in New York and London, and thrilled to have you here at Cinobio in Italy. We'll touch on Brexit here, and we can do that with the Baron of Gatley. Lord O'Neill joins us now. Jim O'Neill of Goldman Sachs Asset Management and so many others, including his public service to the conservative governments of his United Kingdom. Where is Gatley?
It is a suburb of Manchester. Some people who are listening, hopefully in the States, may have origins there. It's affectionately known as the center of the universe.
It's the center of the universe.
Exactly.
As we know it.
It's where the cotton industry started from.
Is Gatley...
Gatley is a suburb about 5 miles south. It's where I was raised as a kid.
Yeah. Is Gatley attached to Brexit like it seems everyone within 100 feet of Parliament is? Is Gatley attached to the comedy at Parliament?
No. No. And what is... there's so many fascinating social angles of it.
Yes.
You know, a lot of English people think just get on with it. We don't understand it. We don't understand why it's so complex. We didn't really understand what we're voting for, but just do something about it so we don't have to have this never-ending nonsense every day of our lives.
I don't want to spend too much time on this because I think so many of our listeners worldwide and across America are basically Brexited out. But the great curiosity for America is your prime minister. She seems to be absolutely original. You worked in previous conservative
government. I actually worked for 3 months under her.
Oh, you worked for... I did not know that.
When Cameron left and all... She asked me to stay on.
And, what kind of conservative issue?
I did. I would say, you know, I'm not. I was not a member. Never have been a member of the Conservative or any other political party. I did it because of the specific job to do with the so-called Northern Powerhouse, Britain's relationship with China, and actually, of course, the antibiotic resistance stuff. And so I think they're all a bit strange, to be honest with you. And importantly, in the dilemmas of the Brexit thing, this is a political party that only has 100,000 members in it and declining. And most of them are quite old. And part of the whole problem, and here it relates to the personality of the Prime Minister, a lot of the motivations driving the strategy have been aimed unsuccessfully at trying to keep the Conservative Party... Okay, as a population of getting close to 65 million, doing that for the interests of 100,000 or less elderly people is a mistake. But she feels very loyal to the Conservative Party thing, and I would I describe her as a sort of 1950s type rural English person. And she's not particularly intrigued in the world or the machinations of the world.
Just in the time that we've got left, Jim O'Neill, and you've been very kind with Bloomberg today here at Chernobyl, Italy. I need to talk to you, and this is a Jim O'Neill that many of you may not know, that's really focused on process of business. Lawrence Fink at BlackRock talks about, as Michael Porter did at Harvard a number of years ago, it can't just be about profit.
No,
and yet every day that's what we see.
I've become fascinated by this in my, 6 years since I left Goldman, and particularly during this antibiotic resistance review I led. You know, we estimated 27 interventions needed globally to solve the risk of growing resistance to antibiotics and 10 million deaths by 2050. Huge problem. $43 billion needed to spend on those interventions. And big pharmaceutical companies are essentially increasingly getting out of the antibiotic business because it's not profitable. But here's the link. Just the top three American participants, during the time of our review, spent nearly as much as they could buying back their own shares in that $43 billion. I think last year, share buybacks in the U.S. went through the $1 trillion mark. And I question the incentive structure, the whole... risk versus return incentives for modern publicly quoted business leadership, where it seems to regard whatever you do, you just have to use things like share buybacks to make sure your profits are always better than expected. And that is so much an easier option than actually investing in not only social needs, but also their own long-term businesses.
No, we got so
and it's very disappointing, and it's great to see somebody like Larry being a champion of it, and we need more of it.
Let me do this because I think this is just so important to our audience on so many different levels. I'd love to get you at some time in the next 12 months for a half-hour special, even an hour special, to really address this idea. Folks, this goes back to Michael Porter at Davos six, seven years ago.
I'd love to do that. One of the most important things in my modern life.
My executive producer here, Bowden, would take a note, except he's got a pastry in his mouth. Jim O'Neill, thank you so much.
That's very unfair.
Lord O'Neill, and we got through this Lisa Abramowitz.
They're nice pastries here.
They are. We got through this Lisa Abramowitz without a quote on pound sterling.
I see. Well, I will say, I hope you enjoy your pastries over in Genovia, Italy.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.